We live in a racially divided society. Everyone wants to assume that it's post-racial, but most people are living in fairly homogeneous environments, and they think that they know people of another race because people of another race are proximate. But that doesn't mean they are friends, they are relatives, they are neighbors, they are classmates, those kinds of issues. So everybody starts in the place of trying to figure this race thing out and feeling that they're uncomfortable talking about it, because to talk about race often means to be racist or to be accused of being racist or of creating racism yourself through your own speech. So it's starting off in a really uncomfortable place for a lot of people, particularly young people who don't feel they were here when any of the racial conflict occurred. We all want to live in a world where it's wonderful, it's fair, it's equal, it's equitable, and we can appreciate one another. And we try to live in that world. But every so often, incidents burst through to the surface, and they remind us that things aren't as easy as we would like them to be.
What type of incidents are you talking about? In the last few months that you've seen, or in recent history that you think demonstrate what you're talking about?
I think there's one very interesting incident in Sweden I'd encourage you to look at. About 2 years ago, it was a cake that was made for an art installation, and it seems like that would be a pretty benign thing. The artist was a biracial artist making this lovely cake, and yet the event itself was very controversial because the cake was perceived as being quite racist. What it did was it depicted a black woman's body in a very stereotypical, mammy-like fashion. And people who attended the opening of this particular exhibit were encouraged to cut the cake, eat pieces, and drink champagne while chatting with the artist. Some people were really offended by that particular event. Something closer to home that occurs in many schools, I'm going to talk about campus issues now, not just the culture overall. I think we can see that Ferguson and places like that, there are certainly issues. But people like to think that those are far afield, different places don't affect them.
Yeah.
But campuses, for example, desegregating sororities and fraternities. My sense is that the little bit of time that I've been here, I've heard that that kind of incident is something that some schools are challenged when they do that, and other schools struggle and somehow make it work.
I don't know how many schools. I think it's just Alabama, quite frankly. I don't know how many. I don't know how unique or how common that is. It seems to be a kind of a singular issue here in Alabama. For example, Ole Miss, which has a very horrific history in terms of race relations. In fact, up until 1998, I believe, students were allowed to carry Confederate flags into their football stadium on sticks, and then it was finally kind of put down then. Up until the late 90s, they have had an African-American SGA president not that long ago, and their Greek system is much more desegregated than ours, so it does seem to be kind of a unique issue.
I'm not claiming that every place is even, but I think to arrange them along a trajectory of who's doing better and worse can misread the local situation. You can have a situation where you're doing better in some things and worse in others. And I also think it's really important not to assume that because you have a visible black face who is on a team or in a classroom, that one or two means things are desegregated. You see. Mm. So the notion of looking at the data, who's at the bottom in this particular society, who's at the top, who has high literacy rates, who doesn't, who gets jobs in Silicon Valley and who doesn't, to take a step back and say, how are our educational institutions preparing students to be critical thinkers and to live in a multicultural, diverse world? Because that is what it is. Mm. You see. So the sorority fraternity issue is yet one example of just something that's smaller. There are some fraternities and sororities that are doing great jobs, but having one black member or two black members doesn't necessarily mean that integration has occurred on the campus. It may make the campus look good, but it doesn't mean it has occurred.
Let me get your opinion on this, as we're on the Greek issue. I think the numbers would bear this out, although we haven't done a study on it, although I think it makes sense. You look at these houses, you have to pay thousands of dollars to join these clubs. It's not necessarily something that people from lower class groups could do. So therefore, you would imagine that these people in these groups are probably from backgrounds that are a bit more affluent.
Yes.
Do you think that that perhaps is a perhaps reason for this? Because it is a larger cultural issue that African Americans are making less, and that there are years and years of economic subjugation, and perhaps this is sort of a lagging indicator.
I think it's a factor. I wouldn't call it a cause. I would call it a factor. Clearly, there are inequalities built into the system that we all inherited. The question is, what do we do about the system that we've inherited from here on? So I'm very interested in generational issues. If I were in a, I'm not going to be in a fraternity, but if I were in a sorority, I were a young woman in a sorority, I would want to know, what kind of policies does my sorority have that might be those particular policies? If we as a group in my sorority wanted to be more inclusive, would we be blocked by our parents and our grandparents, who in fact are funding our education and perhaps are paying our entry fees into these particular organizations? So at some point, who is responsible for analyzing and making changes and taking leadership in areas like race? If I could back up a little bit, your comment about class is also very interesting, because intersectionality, I want to really pronounce that term clearly for your listeners. This is not intersexuality,
right.
That's something else, all right?
Well.
Intersectionality talks about the intersections of race and class and gender, and how those things work together to provide a complex experience for us. So your example of the fraternity and saying perhaps the legacy of these fraternities and sororities is to have accumulated wealth that enables the children of certain families to benefit is the kind of thing we need to take on in America. Not that that's a bad thing, but that basically to move forward, we have to find a way to find equity. So intersectionality begins to give us a tool to do that.
Where does gender play in a lot of this as well? Because as if we're using Alabama as an example, the sororities were the ones that were forced to desegregate. The fraternities were not. And some people feel that there's a double standard there between men and women, and that the idea is that, well, you know, boys can be boys. You got to be tough, and if you can't join the group, then whatever. But girls, now we got to intercede here. And make we have to make a kind of effort.
Well, that's certainly one way to think about it. I would wonder whether you're looking at traditional sources of male power, and boys will be boys, and boys will become men who will, in fact, run things. Girls will be girls, and girls will grow up to marry the men who run things. And we have fraternities and sororities to, in fact, bring about certain gender roles. In this case, it would be you're talking about white affluent students, because you mentioned the class issues of the fraternities and the sororities. So it seems to me we're talking about that same complexity to really take that intersectional lens and say, what is it about fraternities at Alabama? And I could use any school, by the way. It's a lovely school. I want to let you know that. Right? But what is it about fraternities and sororities at Alabama that would benefit from this kind of an intersectional framework that shows us how race, class, and gender work together in shaping their programs, their participants, their future?
We're speaking to Dr. Patricia Hill Collins here from the University of Maryland. Tonight she's giving a speech promoting anti-racist education. It's titled Sharpening Intersectionality's Critical Edge, Implications for Education. It's at 6 p.m. in Graves Hall, room 118.
Doctor, I had a question. So, do you think recently there's a new movie, because you're near D.C., the movie called Dear White People. do you think the media is now starting to combat this intersectional issue?
I think intersectionality is making its way into the mainstream in terms of how movies are being presented. I have not yet seen this movie. It'll be released tomorrow, I believe. It's opening tomorrow.
On the 24th, I believe. But I know they're
that is tomorrow. Friday.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, the whole notion of thinking about the world through a race-only lens or a gender-only lens or a class-only lens or a sexuality-only lens is a limited lens. Most of us live lives that are much more complicated than that. And the difficulty of talking about, let's say, a black man, a young black man or a young black woman, is that those lives are also race, class, gender, and sexually specific. Difficult to talk about, But a film that can be a satire. My understanding is that this film is a satirical treatment of college life. Would be a really good way to get at these issues. I think one reason that humor is so popular among young people is it's a place to be irreverent and to really take on these kinds of issues and say we can actually, this is a place that feels safer for us to deal with these kind of complicated themes that we started talking about earlier in the interview. So I'm looking forward to seeing that film. It seems like it's in the tradition of School Days, where there was an effort made to do the same thing. It's sort of in that tradition of let's revisit college from time to time to see what's happening there. We've come a long way from Animal House, for example.
In the closing minutes of our conversation, I have a couple more questions for you. First off, we'll get to your lecture in just a second tonight. More about that in specifics, but what is the election of Barack Obama? What has that done? We're 6 years past it now. Mm-hmm. He will soon no longer be president. This is his last midterm election that he will face as president. What has that done to, I don't know, complicate the situation, or what has it done? I'll just ask you that way.
I think it's done a couple of things. The first thing that it's done is it's made many people recognize that you cannot just have one black messiah who's going to save either the United States or the world. Many people had a narrow view of politics that assumed that if you just elect the right person, that somehow all will work beautifully. And that's just much too much for any one person to do. One thing that it's done is it's also showed us the interest groups in this country and how intractable they are, how dug in they are, and how polarized the country is. And Barack Obama came in wanting to not have a polarized country. That is what he ran on. It was very much a multicultural, multigender, multi-ethnic agenda. And yet that was extremely difficult to do because one person can't do that. That's a bottom-up agenda that has to occur. So I think one thing that comes out of this, hopefully, is that people do not become apathetic, but that they say, what was I really committed to? What was the vision I saw? But that strategy might be a limited strategy to put all our eggs in one basket.
What about in terms of race relations and specifics, though? Do you think, for example, Ferguson happened,
yeah,
and Barack Obama's president, and I guess what you're saying is that you have one person, whoever that person is.
I'm saying that politics are local. And that people have to work in their local communities. So there's always this tendency to blame the other guy and to say they have it worse, so it's really horrible over there. But because we don't have conflict or problems that I can see in my community, all must be wonderful. And then say, and Barack Obama is president, therefore it really must be wonderful. That's the icing on the cake. But when you strip it back, his accomplishments are what they are. But when you strip it back, politics are local. So Ferguson is a community that is wounded by realizing the kind of community it really is. It was living, thinking that it was post-racial, and recognizes now that perhaps it is not. And that's on both sides. So that's a community that has to really reorganize itself to be a community as opposed to a divided state.
But you have a lot of people. Bill O'Reilly famously a few days ago said on Jon Stewart's show that there is no such thing as white privilege in America. It just doesn't exist anymore. Maybe it did 40 years ago, exactly what you're saying. Maybe it did 40 years ago, but now it doesn't exist. We are a meritocracy. People can rise up if they want to. I mean, does that still exist?
I don't think those two things go together. All right. I would think about whether there is white privilege and what that means and what white privilege has meant in the past. There have been large numbers of white people in this country who have been poor. And that is the best kept secret of the people who are privileged, who historically have been white and male. So I don't know. We live in a world where the face of power may not have that whiteness attached to it anymore. But that does not mean, that's a separate issue from there's a meritocracy where people can work their way up from the bottom. Up to a point, yes. But it's really uneven. Native peoples who are still arguing to try and get the Washington Redskins to change their name, people in Cleveland who are trying to get that mascot gone, whatever that is. We're on radio, so I really wish I had a picture to hold up and show. So Google, your listeners can Google that to see what that's all about, are still struggling for basic access and opportunity. You can't tell me that it's a meritocracy if you have Native American reservations or if you have black people living in Baltimore. Just watch the show The Wire. Watch the five-year sequence on HBO, which shows you the challenges of living in certain communities and tell me that there's equity of opportunity at this point. When we have equal opportunity, then we can say we have a meritocracy because we'll see who rises to the top and who doesn't, because they've all had a fair shot. Those are two separate issues. The wealth white privilege issue, I call that a wealth issue, all right, and the meritocracy access to opportunity issue. Now, if O'Reilly is conflating those two, perhaps he needs to take a step back and chat with some folk about this a bit more.
Right. Tonight, 6 p.m., you're speaking in Graves Hall, Room 14, and as the title of your lecture talks about, it has to do with education.
Yes.
And what role education plays in this whole argument. Do you feel that the fact that some of these things still exist, that you have a police force in Ferguson, Missouri, by the way, for example, that is a majority African-American town where pretty much everybody on the police force is white. That seems a little strange. You have a lot of other issues. Do you think that to its core is an issue of education?
I wouldn't put everything on the backs of education. I think education cuts both ways. It is a route of access and upward social mobility. It is a way of bringing people together who have lived separate lives and helping them figure out what they have in common and what their differences are. But it can also be a way of, can be a major gatekeeper of keeping some groups down and elevating other groups up. So, for example, if I'm privileged and I go to a prep school and my class has 15 students in it and my teacher explains things to me when I don't understand them, I'm getting a really good leg up and I'm in the 11th grade taking chemistry. But if I'm in a city school where my chemistry teacher may come or not come occasionally, or if I'm in Appalachian, I don't even have a chemistry teacher, that kind of thing, it's a rural area, then how am I expected to compete when I get to college, if in fact I get to college? So that would be, education is ground zero for those types of issues.
Well, very interesting. Dr. Patricia Hill Collins from the University of Maryland. Go Terrapins, I guess.
Go Terps.
All right. We appreciate you joining us here, and welcome to the University of Alabama. Have a fun time tonight. It's at 6 p.m. in Graves Hall, room 118. Dr. Patricia Hill Collins, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right. You're listening to 90.7 The Capstone, the voice of the University of Alabama.